Okay. Thank you all so much for being here. Thanks for joining with us as we got started for the final time this year with the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. So and there is talk of, maybe doing this again next year. So definitely stay tuned for that. Obviously, we do a lot of other great poetry, a lot of it with the people you've heard this summer all throughout the year. So you can always check those out on our website. So this week eight, season finale, will feature writers Jason Baldinger, Sharon Fagan McDermott, Dina November, and Adriana E. Ramirez. We are delighted to have them, in the case of all of them, have them back. So thank you. And we have loved hosting the Hemingway's crowd here in the store. We got to do it virtually last year. We got to do it in the new space this year. We so appreciate this community of writers, and it means a lot to us that you trust us with your program, Chris and Joan. So yeah, a quick round of applause for Christopher Collins and Joan Bauer. So a little bit about myself and White Whale Bookstore. You all can probably recite this part with me because you've heard it all summer, but just in case you're not familiar with us or it's your first time here, I'm Anna, the events director at White Whale Bookstore. We are a family-owned general interest independent store in the scenic Bloomfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Our store motto is conversation, community, and culture, and we strive to be a home for book lovers. Our events programming features local, national, and international writers and translators reading, discussing, and celebrating literature of all genres and for all ages. So, a couple of events coming up throughout this month that we think you might be interested in. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the 10th at 7 p.m. Eastern, is a virtual poetry reading with Coffee House Poets. We're super excited to virtually host Eloisa Amezcua, the author of Fighting Is Like a Wife, along with Daniel Brzezinski, author written after a massacre in the year 2018. So that's online. Saturday, August 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern, come to the launch and celebration of Kamal E. Kimball's poetry chapbook from Pitty Mill Press, The Mouth That Sucks the Bone. She'll be joined by two beloved locals, Lisa Summey and Kelly Andrews. And there will be a live stream available for that, just as there is tonight. That is Little Italy Day weekend. So just it's gonna be great. Kamal knows, like we're ready to go, but just like so you're aware with parking and et cetera. And there's a live stream. So and then the last one I just wanted to shout out tonight is on the 24th at 7 p.m. We are ecstatic to host an out-of-towner, the co-founder and managing editor of Red Hen Press, Kate Gale, for a poetry reading celebrating her latest, The Loneliest Girl. And she'll be reading alongside someone we love oh so dearly, Kayla Sargeson, author of Head on a Shelf, with an introduction by Jan Beatty. So that'll be here in the store. Can't be missed. Live stream available for that too. And as always, you can find out about all of our events at whitewhalebookstore.com/events. We have a ton of stuff coming up this fall. I'm like figuring out even more stuff in the calendar today. So it's going to be great. We're currently live streaming. A lot of folks at home, thank you for joining us. And for folks here in the store, some notes about sort of protocol. We're still in a pandemic. We do ask that you keep your mask on at all times if you're not actively eating or drinking. The restrooms are behind me. I just ask that you hold off on heading back there if possible until the end of the event. The door at the back of the cafe is locked just so that I can keep checking Vax cards on the other side. But at the end of the event, if you want to go out that way, the bolt's just right on the door. You can flip it. And speaking of this side of the store with the cafe is open for the duration of the event. Last call for the cafe will be as soon as the event's over. So that just gives KG over here some time to start cleaning up and get out of here on time. If it suddenly sounds like the sink is like leaking, that's normal. That's just the ice machine draining. It's just like 60 seconds and then it's done. And we have copies of everybody's books in stock. We have copies of Jones and Chris's books too. Specifically, the one I have on the table for Chris is his latest Roundabout Trace, which we'll be doing an event for in the fall, details to come. So yeah, I just ask that you grab them here and then purchase them from me next door before finding the authors to get their signatures or anything like that. That's all from me. So I will turn it over to Christopher Collins to get us started. Thank you again.
Hi. So, hey, not there. It really is a good microphone. This is the third microphone Hemingway series has been through this season. It's awesome. Thank you for coming out to the finale tonight. The finale was always a very special event at Hemingway's. When I started interloping at Hemingway's with Jimmy, it was always at the finale. So that's where I got my start. He would ask me to put it together. So it's always been very special to me personally. And it's always been kind of a party, a celebration of the entire season. So thank you for coming out tonight, and thank you for tuning in on Zoom. Thanks again, as always, to White Whale Bookstore for riding in during the pandemic and really saving the series. I don't think we could have really done it without them. Anna and Halsey in particular have just really, really been a part of the Hemingway's team and family intrinsically. We just could not do this series like this without them. So thank that to them. And thanks to you for coming out. And thanks to Joan for putting up with me. And thanks to you tonight for putting up with me. I'm going to read this. And this was written by Jimmy Savitic. This is from his collection, Tales of the Mad Dog. You want to check that out. This is called Neda Aga Sultan. Those fuckers. Those rotten fuckers. I asked my friend, would you write a poem about the woman killed in Iran? And she shook her head, yes. I asked her, did you see how they killed her? They shot her in the chest. She was innocent of any wrongdoing. She was just standing there watching. She was dead before she hit the ground. And blood poured from her mouth. I've seen it before. And I knew she was dead. Look at her eyes. Look at her eyes. She was dead. I wanted all the poets in the world to write a poem. I want all the poets to write a poem. All to write a poem. Write a poem. Anyone. Write a poem. Everyone, please write. Please write a poem. All to write a poem. I have been afraid for days now. A strange fear. Deep sorrow of fear. A fear that I know will stay with me until I die. A fear for my daughter. Fear for my granddaughter. A fear for the women that I love. Deep fear for my sisters. A fear for the older women that have washboard fingers. Fear for women that can no longer give birth. Fear of the death of songbirds. Fear for all women. My head hurts this morning. I took a shower and tried to wash off the days of sad memory. I thought of Whitman. For some strange reason, Dickinson and Neruda and Dalton of San Salvador. I spoke with them as I washed my face and the soap running down my chest, my pot of a stomach, pubic hair, penis, thighs, calves, my feet, white soap spinning, soap circling in the drain. I pleaded with them, help me write the poem that will bring peace in a world that knows only how to kill. Help me put out the flames of the burning tires and make the black smoke go away. Pablo, I know you have tried for decades to stop war, but I know together we can stop the senseless killing. Help me, Walt Whitman, to silence the guns. And once we have silenced the guns, we can bury the guns or melt them down and make huge bridges out of them or even large ships. In Tehran, there are many guns, and all night they are fired into the sky, and there are many tracers that split the night. In the morning sun, there are many bodies that lay in the street, and everyone is afraid to bury the dead. I dried myself off, and there was a wet footprint on the bathroom floor. I dropped the wet towel onto the floor, wiping my feet dry, and I thought of virgins being thrown into a volcano by high priests. And it's crazy. Why do I think of virgins and priests? I'm not sure they were all virgins. But I want to believe they all had the innocence of virgins and the beauty of early spring. I want to believe if they were not virgins, only one lover would know for sure, and he cried alone at night with his secret. I know that the priests were not holy men, because holy men would not push anyone into the flames. Holy men would jump into the flames themselves, like the Buddhist monk in Saigon who set himself on fire, how he burned like a dry California pine in August sun. And he never uttered so much as a scream. He just fell to the earth in a burning heap. I remember the holy smoke coming from his burning body, and I wanted to stand and breathe the smoke into my lungs. I want to fill my lungs with his holiness and blow puffs of his smoke in the faces of the angry, blow smoke into the faces of the insane, into the generals, into the faces of presidents, into the great chamber of the United Nations until they choke from his holy smoke. I want to go to France and find the grave of the man that shot the arrow that struck Joan of Arc. And I want to dig up his bones. I have this strange desire to use his femur as a drumstick. I want to march the streets of Tehran and pound a drum using his femur to beat a drum. The woman's name was Neda. And I'm told that her name means voice. I am told that her voice will live forever, like the winds that kiss the tops of cold mountains. Her voice will sing like a songbird in the morning. Her voice will be louder than a rifle crack. Her voice will be like the child that whispers in a grandmother's ear. Voice. Voice pure. Pure as a cloudless sky. I can't help but wonder if the man that pulled the trigger of the rifle smiled. You know, they always smile when they watch a body crash to the earth. It's natural to smile, as if Satan had just tickled his soul with a feather. I wonder if he could feel the recoil of the rifle into the pit of his shoulder. You can always feel the recoil when you fire a rifle, and it has an impact that stays with you forever once you pull the trigger. I pulled the trigger before, and I can verify the power. And yes, always the smell of the gun grease. It has power, and a smell of gun grease, it stays with you, and it gets on your tongue. And that taste lasts for days and never leaves your memory. Neda Aga Sultan is such a beautiful name. Almost as beautiful as soft brown eyes of love. And this is what we've killed. Jimmy started the Hemingway's poetry series, summer series, in I think 1974, as best as we can determine. Jimmy always had a different date, I think. But as for as long as I attended readings, Jimmy always ended the event by saying, "You have honored poetry." And he was speaking to the poets, and he was speaking to the audience. And since we've lost Jimmy, Joan has ended every night that we've done this in the same way. "You have honored poetry." And I think about that a lot. I mean, it seems like a fine thing to say after an event and everybody feels good about it. But what does it actually mean? I never really pressed Jimmy on that. Usually he was talking about some Bukowski book he was trying to buy for me. But you have honored poetry. And I think Jimmy, in his poetry, really tried very hard to honor the spirit of the thing as he understood it. And Jimmy was a great moralist. He loved dick and fart jokes, and he put a lot of those into his poems, which are great. But he was a moralist. I mean, so did Alexander Pope put a lot of dick and fart jokes in his poetry too. So it's a long, fine tradition. So when we continue to say, even without Jimmy here, "You have honored poetry," what do I think that means? Looking back on the season, after this is the first time we've actually been together in person in years. We're not at Hemingway's anymore. We can't be there because, you know, we just want everybody to be safe. And we want to honor the series and Jimmy's spirit of it. I think what Jimmy meant at this point in my life, thinking about it, when he says, "You have honored poetry," he meant, "You have become vulnerable to everyone in this room and to the world." And I think the poets do that. And the poets tonight, I know their work, they will do that. You have become vulnerable. You have allowed others into your most intimate of spaces by open invitation, knowing full well what at this time in this country that I can bring in this world. And yet you continue to do it because you trust that the people sitting here respect that and they honor it as well. And I think that's what we do. The nights that we do this, we try to honor Jimmy and we try to honor his idea of what poetry could do. And that poem that I read, I feel like is Jimmy at a very naked, very vulnerable spot for him. He is a very brash, loud guy. I watched him walk into a poetry reading of his own led by a marching band. That's a ballsy move for anyone to do. And yet it seemed perfectly natural. He just owned that. He is a continuing inspiration to me. And I hope to honor him as we continue on with the series, as we honor poetry. So I just want to thank everybody who has read for the series for us this year, and everyone who has come out, whether it's Zoom or live in person. You have all honored that spirit. And that is something that we can never have enough of in this world. So thank you very much. I'm going to turn it over to Joe.
How many of you here have been at Hemingway's when it was at Hemingway's and had a chance to No, Jimmy. Okay, great. Not all of you. So I will just add to that and say that Jimmy did found the series about 1974, and he ran it pretty much single-handed for until about 12, 14 years ago. And single-handed, even though he had a day job, and that day job was being an undercover narcotics officer and a homicide officer. So he had kind of a busy life. And he was also had served in Vietnam, and it was very rare that he would not speak about the terrible losses from Vietnam and the terrible losses on the streets of Pittsburgh and other cities and around the world. And I really thank you for reading that poem. He also he organized with his partner a whole series of boxing programs for young people, and got a whole lot of young men and some women to engage in something which gave them a sense of dignity and a competitive spirit and a sense of them having a place in the world that probably might not have had otherwise. Some of that still goes on. So thank you all again for being here. And Jimmy, I would just say that Jimmy was really hard to get him to read his own poems. I mean, it was really hard. All we could get him to do was to read the titles. And he would stand up there and he would say, well, he looked like he's going to start to read the poem. He said, no, no, no. Then he'd go on to the next title. No, no, no. And he would really, but on a few occasions, like toward the end of his life, he really did full readings. But on a few occasions, he did astonishing readings you got to see what he really knew how to do. But he was so self-effacing, and he was brash and self-effacing. It was very confusing. Thank you all. And so let's start with tonight. And all the people reading tonight have read at Hemingway's before, and it's great to have them back. And our first reader tonight is Jason Balder, who is a poet from Pittsburgh. Yes, yes. And his newest books, these may not be his newest books because he has so many books. I think I'm 5 or 10 books behind whatever his really newest books, but some of his recent books include A Threadbare Universe, The Afterlife is a Hangover, A History of Backroads Misplaced, Selected Poems, and he has a forthcoming book, which is probably out already, called This Still Life, and a bunch of his books are here, and you can also read his work on Bandcamp and on LPs from the Gotta Beds and Theramonster. Okay, please welcome Jason Baldinger.
Big reveal. It is a face. All right. Hi. It was me. It was. Let me take these glasses off because I can't see the words otherwise. Welcome to middle age, for whatever it's worth. Anyway, hi, I'm Jason Baldinger. Thanks for having me to Joan and Chris. It's really wonderful to read with Dina and Adriana and everyone else. And this book is called This Still Life, which is out. It's a split between James Benger and myself. He and I have done 3 books together. This poem is called Civic Arena, March 7th, 1984. And I can only say I never thought I'd write a Van Halen poem. But when you walk into the post office and Patty says, "Did you hear Eddie Van Halen died?" and gives you a look, but doesn't tell you the story, I think this poem is the story. Civic Arena, March 7th, 1984. Snow on the dash. Snow crunches under the tires of a 77 Rabbit, her friend's boyfriend with a handful of pills to share. She plastered a pint in her jeans. Security never looked anywhere.
Into the dark of the floor, fog machine smells the pills, slowing down, speeding up together. Diamond Dave glitter blur from this far away. Running with the devil in eruption. She never cared for long solos, but whiskey and counting 23 times for the word jump. It's infinity. What's infinity? Drunk enough on her boyfriend's shoulders, arms up gigantic as they tore into Ain't Talking About Love. Last song and it's everything spinning. Freedom is a ghost waiting to go numb. The post office ain't the same. Wild once, there ain't nothing wild left of what remains.
This book is called A Threadbare Universe. It came out in 2020. There are copies over there. And this poem is called Dragons and Yom. It's for Chris Collins.
It's a rare spring day. The sky hung with jewels pushes the temperature into a different season. I seek shelter on the couch, exhausted as a white cat in this ocean afternoon. Snowmen in breakaway pants roll with a nine pin, one strike of thunder. I crack a beer. The boy went down easy. I wonder just what the fuck is a young berry. I have the afternoon. This moment, the windows open, the rafter outside cocoons ambient sound. I wonder if my son dreams these moments as I hear him stir in the monitor. I wonder if his first memories will be these long, languid afternoons that stretch out for years. We have nothing to do. These afternoons disappear so fast, faster each swing, faster than we can be unsure. Faster than we hold what's expired, faster than bottle sweat evaporates. You're a very attentive audience. That's quite nice. Thank you.
This chapbook, The Topography of Disappearing, was put out by Between Shadows Press, which is run by Tom Bacalus from New Jersey. It's in a limited run of 25, and it sold out almost immediately. This poem netted me a Pushcart nomination. It's called Let Go of Atlantis.
Jerry believes in ivory soap. He believes in starched collars. His spine is straight. He says all the flying plagues of Florida are nearsighted. Don't give them room to smell. I miss the manatees out in some cove near the launch pad that's etched in our consciousness. I see rockets in the rear view, and I want to write about shoveling snow as a boy, about dreams exploding, about hot cocoa and Kristen McAuliffe. Jerry says for 15 bones, they'll give me a sea kayak and I can paddle over the surf to a barrier island all my own. Out there, cooking hamburger helper over a pocket rocket, I'll turn back ahead time. I'll forget my couth and go native. Going native is a racist term meant to minimize the people who were killed so this land could be our land, a universe of violence. It seems that every inch of this land is steeped in blood, and I wonder if a barrier island off the coast of the Atlantic may be one of the few places that I can step where that blood doesn't well up, a hot spring of unacknowledged history. I'm gonna stay out here. An island a mile away from civilization, the sun paints the sky every 12 hours, and every day the ocean steps a little higher. When it reaches my neck, I'll know it's time to let go of Atlantis.
So this, The History of Backroads, Misplaced Selected Poems 2010 to 2020. My God. I've been doing this a while. I basically, over the pandemic, rewrote a bunch of old poems and crammed them into this book, so, or re-edited, I should say. There's also two or three chapbooks that are now out of print and one book that never came out that's in here. This is from a book that didn't come out. It's called Like Neil Young in Albuquerque. If you ever wondered how Jack Gilbert and Neil Young can exist in a poem together, you're about to find out.
The couple at the door see my shirt and ask if I brought the rain. If I knew them better, I'd say in this town, rain has a habit of following you. It's a thing you can't shake. Solitary dark clouds at your heels. Today I feel like Neil Young in Albuquerque, wanting breakfast, a joint, and anonymity. I've felt this way for several seasons, clawing and uncomfortable, something I can't shake, so instead I ease into it, half measures. The waitress yawns, waiting for order up. I used to come here with my grandfather, weekly dinners in the wake of my father's death, his best attempts to be part of my life, but never knowing how to relate. I think of my father, who if you ask him what he wanted for breakfast, he always said eggs Benedict, although I never saw him order it. Strange that even at the far end of our cities, we find our histories glaring. And I wonder if turning 40 has anything to do with this feeling. Age puts weight on you, and I mean that metaphorically. I consider my father dead over 30 years, my grandfather gone over 20. I consider generations, all the boughs of a bloodline tree. Red-shirted cooks spin around an open range, an array of Belgian waffles and strawberries, of eggs and toast, of home fries a la carte, of Greek omelets appear out of the tornado, the ballet, the flickers of fire, this furnace glows indelible forever. A young black kid and an old Marine bus, and when they pause, I see the same look on their face, the indignity of work, the pain, physical labor. Is it a muscle memory or a generational memory? Our dreams squeezed out of or nothing. The rain has mostly stopped. Couples cringe under their umbrellas. I cross the bridge to take when things get serious and then turn around and cross the North Versailles welcome sign and then cross it again. The Edgar Thompson works looks the same as it does on the cover of Jack Gilbert's Tough Heaven. His poems flash, the one line surfaces. We find the heart by dismantling what the heart knows. There's a bunch of poems with oceans, and then this is another one. It's called Kerouac Go Home. We'll give this out to Sylvie tonight since he's mentioned. I hear the waitress's footfalls, and they sound like roses as they echo at Avenue B. As they echo at the Avenue of the Americas, as they echo at the intersection of Bleecker and the Duel, where Soulsby can't understand why there are so many fucking people. Sure, he's got a few drinks in him, but I never thought I'd see New Yorkers turn heads and open indictments of procreation, or at least procreation with the intent of furthering the fading bulb of humanity. Jay and Allie say they used to write Kerouac Go Home on the men's room wall at the White Horse. Dylan Thomas bleeds out. That blood trail runs to the Chelsea Hotel. I slipped on it when I tried to remember the last time I had a future. I tried to remember the last time I saw the ocean. There were Mustangs racing on Garden State Parkway. There were little hands waving on the BQE. I swear there was a Liberty torch in the harbor, its head struggling above the surface. I've snagged myself a driftwood sculpture. There's so much debris, the gulls have picked through the soft shell of the horseshoe crabs, the few untouched are boiling to burst. But the ocean, it still waves under the twin eyes of lighthouses. It never bothered with magic or loss. This next poem is based on a photograph I took. You don't need the photograph because you got the poem, hopefully. And it's for Angel Ellis. Contrails fade. Sun tries to breathe life into the old city mission. The Art Deco era written in lampposts, watched by eagles bronzed and way back. The wind across Montebank afternoon stretches a flag to the point it could break, then take to the sky a kite of freedom imagined, like the leaves that decorate this hillside's bare trees. I think I've got three more poems for you, and then I'll shuffle my way over there to the bullpen. This is from my buddy Will Hackney, who just sent me a postcard and some photos from the Salton Sea. It's called The Only Other Thing Is Nothing. I got your postcard from the edge of civilization in a resort town where water stopped like time in the shimmer of 118 degrees, out where sea levels still can't find the sea. California has eluded me. I haven't seen the Salton Sea, but I missed Zabriskie Point. I missed armed attendants pumping $5 gas under a blazing Mojave sun. Desert rats are where the apocalypse already flashed. The last time we shared a desert, you were celebrating life beginning. And as the speeches and dances rolled, I was in the parking lot. Cold moon rises full over the Sierra Blancas. Attempt to be a dutiful partner in a long, if long distance partner, lonely in the clash between living with abandon and living abandoned. I am a yucca, sun-bleached blossoms mummified while she is hostile bland, brandishing the shovel that would eventually bury us. Come morning, I head east with eyes on Lubbock. Beyond Roswell, I spy a pecan grove. Symmetrical oases stretched miles under an unforgiving sun. I park between the rows, stand outside myself. The only other thing is nothing. Two more for you. This is called For Miss Woodchopper. It's a sawdust morning. Seed pods swept off Lover's Lane fall into a low tide river once home to pirates. The salt sulfur well capped, the courthouse sleeps, there's five for a dollar gently used BVDs filling banana boxes in the thrift store. Every year the lumberjacks come, push the motel past capacity, car and chainsaw fumes drift to parades and fireworks. These mountains once again find something to live for. In the all-local market, where products are so hyper-local, they have their makers' telephone numbers written in careful pen. A blonde in a Pink Floyd t-shirt, bored at the counter, says she's going to be Miss Woodchopper this year. This is her year. Besides, she really needs to win. I've been doing a low-key speakeasy reading series in my backyard, which is called The Pit reading series. And Julio Scott Silsby, are reading on Saturday the 20th at 6 p.m. We also have Erie poets Mark and Matt Lazaron, Luke Kuzmish, and Akron poet Chandra Alderman. If you're interested, stop on by. You can ask me for the address. I don't make it public for a reason. This last poem is called The Oxbow on the Sheep Sky. I'm sorry, did I hear somebody heckling me?
You're laughing about
it. I know, it's ridiculous, but whatever. Everybody kind of knows where I live. It's that way. This is the oxbow on the sheep's got. Ocean Point sunset, and then the Christmas lights of Booth Bay, and shrines for the dead, lost in the empty expanse of a pizza shop. He sports a Fu Manchu through 30 years of photos. This wall remembers his daughters work the counter, a Greek sisterhood blessed. Heredity offers the same nose. I've got a cold bottle of Coke, watching it down, jackets and duck boots, grab an easy pre-holiday meal, ice down the stress until tomorrow. The last table reserved for the Virgin Mary and the dead. Photos and prayer candles. I can match the photos and then watch them disappear, slowly fade in the current of time. I'm waiting to hear my name so I can shuffle out into the night, white box on the front seat through the glowing lichen dark. Find the oxbow on the sheep sky that lies beyond the last dream. Blue sand still on my boots. Thank you all so much.
Wow, wow. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah.
Sharon Fagan McDermott is a poet, essayist, and teacher of literature at Winchester Thurston School, yes, here in Pittsburgh. Her most recent collection of poetry, Life Without Furniture, was published in May of 2018. Fagan McDermott has also written three chapbooks, which have really interesting names. Voluptuous, Okay. Allie Scatching and Bisher Acoustic, which was the winner of the 2011 Jackar Press Chapel Contest. She has a new book, a collection of essays on the craft of creative writing with the title Millions of Suns, written with Christine Benner Dixon, which was recently accepted for publication at the University of Michigan Press. So wow and wow. And wow. And please welcome Sharon Fagan McDermott.
Thank you. I am very nervous about taking my mask off. I have not been in a group since COVID began, so this is my first time, except when I'm with the Fagan family, which is my family back east, and they were the only ones I'm maskless with, so this is weird for me, but I don't want to be muffled. Jimmy Savetic said to me once, well, actually, I'm lying. He said it to me many times, which was funny to me. You're not from around here, are you? Which was funny because I've lived here for over 40 years. But I am originally from New Jersey, and I guess I have an East Coast something about me, which he kept teasing me about. But I still miss Jimmy, and I was really appreciative that you read that beautiful poem that was very touching. During COVID, I cheated on poetry. I just didn't want to write it anymore during COVID. I was living alone with my dog. I have no family out here and just want to tell stories. And unfortunately, we have beautiful narrative poets in Pittsburgh, but I'm not one of them. I want to sing in poems and I want to paint pictures in poems. And so I decided I had to write essays, and that's why I wrote my stories. And so I was very over the moon when I found out it's going to get published. So I have a couple of Pittsburgh poems here. The first one is called Tuesday Morning. Blue trucks driving too fast up Cromwell, the brick road around the corner from my house. 6:20 a.m. and he's all reckless disarray, blows through the stop sign. I'm glad the two little backpack boys aren't up and walking to school yet. It doesn't take much to set my teeth on edge anymore. This world's a careless place, a place without care more often than I'd like. But on the next block, Yvonne, who owns the florist shop in Wilkinsburg, is getting into her flower van, and she smiles and says, "You're up early." "Love my work," she shoots back without a trace of irony. So now my mind's turned back to all the flowering, dogwoods, pink and cream, mixing petals with the light rain. Much of this year, I felt broken, sewn up, unsure of what holds a soul together, unsure of what binds us to grace or strength in order to move forward. It's Tuesday morning in the rain. Each brick on the brick houses I pass shimmers dawn. My beautiful dog will need toweling off when we get home. On a neighbor's stoop, I'm suddenly surprised by the sight of two white cats. I name one Chaos, I name one Serenity. Thank you. My dog is terrified of those white cats. They actually always want to come up and greet him, and he's totally frightened of them. Pittsburgh Fugue. Before the moon scrubs grays from the sky, we tried once more to make it right. The lights against the downtown PPG, more commerce now than castle. Three rivers flow against, within, they confluence and flatten with the barges progress on the moon. No better sight than bridges far as sight can see, a galaxy of boats upon the star-filled swells. And in the blue-lit stadium, a roar's gone up, another score. And yet we can't find our way back. No road, no hacked-up trail. The incline's jaunty red stays silent on the south side slopes. The evening dulls with classic rock, pool balls clacking at D's, and the hostile jostling from the crowds on Carson Street. Between us, something cracks and drains. Old love, these bricks, steel girders, the sure shellac of mortar is illusion in this city made of every solid thing. but it's man-made, darling, man-made. And that's where all the crumbling begins. I went to this fabulous exhibit at the Carnegie years ago. I don't know how many years, time is weird to me now. But they had an exhibit called The Industrial Sublime. And the shock of it was all painters who were in love with our pollution way back in the 1900s. And so they came here and lived here deliberately to paint the soot and the smog. And I was just, I'm an environmentalist, so I was like really shocked by this. And so I must have visited that exhibit 20 times. And I wrote down everything in it because I was so fascinated. So this is one little poem I got out of it. Monet did not come to Pittsburgh, but he did love the smog in London. This is called The Industrial Sublime, and it's after Monet's Waterloo Bridge, 1903. Monet loved the transitory play of time, light, weather evoked by smoke and soot and fog. He called it atmosphere, the true essence of a thriving modern city. His London Waterloo Bridge turn of the century was crystallized by gauzy air, a veil that clarified. Industry revealed as romantic mystery, like how the puddles of rain on city walks allowed the early photographers to shimmer their blacks and grays. Monet sealed beauty in the limits of his palette, silver white, cobalt blue, emerald green, vermilion, dark matter. And about the darker matter of killing smog and gasping lungs, water too full of sludge to drink, toxic spew was tempered into dream. To see the air was new, was magical, an alluring invitation, hidden trysts behind a wavering mirage. The fog in London assumes so many colors, marbled Monet. The stench of industry turned to a glossy splash of light on mist, on smog, a toxic spew tempered into a dream. So, I have one in that series that is an actual man who worked in the mills talking, but I'm too frightened to read it to a Pittsburgh audience. So I read it privately to friends who grew up in Pittsburgh, and I said, no, it's good, it sounds, you know, but I'm never probably going to read it at a reading. I'm afraid someone will throw something at my head. I have a couple of pandemic poems here. I know most of us really want to pretend it's gone and it's over and it's normal, but for some of us, including me, it doesn't feel over yet, partly because it took my mother's mind away. So this is called The Summer of Nectarines. And it was written in the summer of 2020. The summer of nectarines was a terrible one. Plague on the winds, in the air, on our tongues, in the midst of old conversations, set within millions of homes, exhausted lamps flicked on and off and on again, all hours. Somewhere, the sound of an infant's wail thick in the limbs of the sycamores. Somewhere, a dog's bark caught in his throat. And the drought-fried grass hosted no fireflies, and the promise of thunderstorms never fulfilled. Someone delivered fruit to me on the porch, nectarines, oddly noble in their blue plastic bags, as if they were already past, objects in an oil painting, maroon and peach solid with sheen. Somewhere a piano struck. Somewhere a cat stretched her long limbs awake. Somewhere a face on a screen like a comet's tail, lit, dissipating. Books tried to intervene, comfort, offer of visions, the old world in a fervent embrace, and heat bore down like the former days of rainstorms. Although this year, look at this. Honeybees went up in whirls of smoke from the lawns. Outside, people rushed by, their apocalyptic eyes darting towards you and away. Head down, run on. The hose water day and night so that something might thrive. Why not zinnias? Why not asters? In the kitchen, the fruit unknotted itself, melted down in the heat, mealy and bruised. But still, in the shrillness of multiple fans, the kitchen erupted in nectarine fragrance. And so too the whole house. And so too the whole day. Thank you. I always allow myself an indulgent poem. This is it. It's one of my leaping poems that will probably make no sense to an audience. I'm aware of that, but I want to read it. I'm sorry. So I allow myself one reading. This is it. It is a pandemic poem. I think I'm trying to evoke a mood more than have you follow its not narrative. It's called 3 Years In. I don't know which breaking builds the easier life or the larger fire. Twigs snapped as kindling, so fragile, fractal. This branch of a pine, its needles prick my arm as I run past, and I'm supposed to be grateful, right? But I'm still caught in this net, such battening down with only the chronic dreams of my younger lover who left moons ago for Alaska to haunt me. Dust, ephemera, the years as changeable as tides, ebb and flow and ebb, past, past, past. Sea glass, that gift of glint from a morning walk, has always eluded me, as have so many answers I've been seeking all my life. In his madness, Hamlet shouted, "Bury like a whale." And those enormous, beauteous beasts felt untouchable then, but have found themselves beached and dying in this ugly new world. And because I cannot sit idly by and simply be a witness to the dying world, I have turned as feral as a dumpster cat, screech and scratch and claw. Who to trust? When to kindle laughter? When to kindle fire and with whom? Brittle, brittle goes this canticle of distance. It's funny when you read it out loud, it's angrier than I thought it was. Like I could feel it when I hear it, like, oh, okay, this is an angry poem. But sometimes you don't know it when you're writing it. This is a poem I just like because, you know, when you don't have family around during a hunkering down COVID pandemic, you fall in love with birds. So that is what I did. So this is called Sparrow. What changes now that I no longer call them small brown birds? Now that I've studied them, this one's gold-flecked wings, that one's tail pointing pertly skyward. Now that I've sorted song from song, beak from beak, flight from flight, attending to their glossary of difference, nothing changes in the world if I say Vesper Sparrow, Bunting, Carolina Wren, or Lark. They're still sloppy in the seeds, skittish with new shadow. They still drop down from the gutters and swell the Rose of Sharon branches early morning, late evening. Seaside Sparrow, Cape Sable, they're on their way in half past Icarus, squabbling over suet. How does it transform the crowd to recognize the individual? I once heard someone say, if you call it a field, no one fights against the men who gut it to make a parking lot. So I call it meadow. Try to know the names of its inhabitants, the bee-drunk hyssop, the buttercups and daisy fleabane, echinacea and clover, wild geraniums, and a crowd of wind-tossed colors live to drink the sun. Those jittery throngs are no longer mud-blurred browns and tans, but gold-crowned, cinnamon, white-rumped snowfinch, and the world feels far less lonely. Don't worry, I don't have all of these. I know where I'm stopping. There's my stuff. So I have three to go. This is called Clarity. Another one, I want to hear it. Sometimes poets do this, I'm telling you the truth. We want to work something out in front of an audience just to see if we need more. I suspect this needs something in the ending, but I also dedicated to my dog, Beowulf, who is now dying of cancer. He was the best companion during COVID, so it is heartbreaking to me that he has cancer at this point. It's called Clarity. Stars bright in the alleyway, dark pocket of the neighborhood, guttered leaves. The dog sniffs the slushy shadows beneath fences. Dog, I say, the grass is lost without the light. My morning thoughts snag and dangle from the crescent moon as we stand on one of the last brick roads in Pittsburgh. Dog noses something, looks up quizzically. Oh, those are glow sticks, dog. I laugh, watching him probe them with his paws. Remember months ago, all those trick-or-treaters you barked away? Black walnut tree heaves, cracks nuts on the sidewalk. We both startle, streetlights halo down. Dog, I say, look at us, we're saints, so holy in the circling light. Dog doesn't bat an eye, he tugs me forward. Moon's about to tip, stars slip, stick to the... This is a tongue twister. Stars slip, stick to the tips of the sycamore's branches. I'm all in. Pre-dawn imagination kindles. Dog starts to trot up Cromwell Street, stops only once to lift his leg on his favorite box hedge. Too early yet for the throngs of crows above. Slow down, dog. It's all in motion. Look, first feathering of the new light. The dog disdains all metaphor. He takes a long whiff of a small pile of leaves. I want to hold to the hushed world without cars and voices, without other humans, no yen to join my workday life. Dog pauses. He lifts his head and sniffs the rose-dipped dawn. Ever the pragmatist, he brings me home.
Just two more.
This is one of my little environment poems. I have in the book that I just wrote, I have an essay about this. Like, I'm really grappling with how do you tell the story of the environment to make people give a shit? Because there's a lot of people don't give a shit because we have so much else we're worried about, right? We're overwhelmed. There's like, look here and look here and look there. So this is just a kind of sweet, silly poem, but it's a poem thinking like I was watching neighbors who were like spraying herbicide all over dandelions. And I was like, oh, for God's sake, why? You know, these are bees' first food. I want to say this, because of course, it makes you very unpopular in the neighborhood if you're the one going around saying things like that. So I decided instead to shrink myself like Alice in Wonderland did in a poem, and I am looking up at a dandelion. It's called Sharon in Wonderland, Dandelion. I've now grown small enough to slip beside the grass blades in the lawn and near the glassy filigree of dandelions gone to seed. 12 dandelions cluster around, apostolic, dun, abundant teachers. I tread gently. The lacy pappus ring around the flower head, the stem a swan's neck tilting with the breeze. The view from down here, look, the widening ladder of the leaves, the toothy angles of a single edge. Would it hold me if I tried to climb it? The view from here, a prophecy of how the light, wind, earth conspire to play their role in dandelions flourishing, mighty suns atop such molten stems, then aids them in their vanishing. Their final legacy, a whimsy rain of seed. I want to rest my head against the stem and hear the water flow from root to petal head. I want to taste the deep green leaf that sways beneath this open sky, whose skeleton looks more like a starling's wing than member of an aster family. But I've been given so much. Drink me, I was told. And so I have slaked my thirst on nature's boundless variety, and I've done so gratefully. Far above me, the seed heads a breathless orb, a nebulae eviscerated by the breeze, a whiskered bridge, a silver salvo, a dawn of stars. That's how I want you to think about dandelions. Thank you. And my last one is a kind of love poem. It is a love poem. It's called How Love Meets the Morning Like Glass. There is rain that doesn't know me. though it slides like fingers down my skin, a shivering. Your finger on my spine, the glide of it turns me to river. Morning comes and you follow an old tabby down the alleyway and vanish into morning fog. Still, the rain's a glassy greenhouse around my life, a site for the small fireworks of zinnias and a twining forest of ivy, weeds, rose of Sharon. Once you said to me, I don't say love, can't say love. It's a word that falls in splinters everywhere like glass. And I nodded, I know, I know. I did not know. It was nonsensical to me, like how sand and lime combines to form the green glass bird upon my kitchen shelf, and how, just after I admired the 5 p.m. light swirling gold within its belly, I dropped it on the tile floor. Sun spilled out everywhere, a mess. Once rain of nourishment, not of floods, drains and sewers afterwards, the overflow, the spiraling down was memorable, but so too was the fevered rise, our bodies twined so tight, we feared we'd lose ourselves, and then we lost ourselves. Furtive nights of parrying, mornings where coffee burnt our tongues and sunrise cold and blistering. But love is not defined by how it turns out in the end. Our hours of joy on wooded trails, the fallen mounds of gold, we were tossed coins and old enough to know better. We both craved, oh, I don't know what we wanted then. And now, I've grown much closer to the weeds. They're mad in love with August. I leave them all alone to thrive and let the rain have its way with everything. Thank you. So lyrical. Wow. So lyrical. Oh gosh. Dina November is the author of Mean Mama. She has edited two anthologies, Brave Woman, no kidding. Very resilient. They are Nasty Women and Bad Hombres. And this other one in 2005, I Just Hope It's Lethal. Her poetry has appeared in Nerve Cowboy, Chiron View, Women Write Resistance, Mom Egg Review, a whole bunch of other places. Her chapbook, Dickwad, was published, just make sure you got that, okay. Was published by Hyacinth World Press. And she holds an MFA in poetry from Carlo, and she's taught pretty much everywhere in Pittsburgh. I mean, she's taught at Robert Morris and Carlo and Seton Hill. And I'm not sure where are you teaching now? Everywhere, she's still teaching everywhere. Okay, and she, for some years, curated the Staghorn Poetry Series in Greenfield, which was stunningly wonderful. Woohoo! And she is now curating a new series, Blue Cactus, at Trace Brewing in Lawrenceville. And that is really, and had a big success with her first launch last month. So yay, so watch out for more on that. And as we have been told often, Dina enjoys strolling through the gardens of Phipps. Please welcome Dina November.
Thank you. Okay. I thought I should go to the bathroom like before the reading started, but then I didn't. Now I'm like, I don't know. It's a weird in between. I feel like we need the bathroom intermission, but it's okay. We'll make it through. Oh yeah, that's true. I will take off my mask. Yeah, I'll be okay. Oh, I can do it. Okay, so I'm gonna alternate between some poems that I have on my phone because I have not printed them out in a long time. And Yes, and the environment, it would be a good reason to. Yeah, I don't know if I've printed a poem out in a long time. Anyways, so I'll hopefully not stumble through that. So I wanted to begin with a poem from my book, Mean Mama, which is for sale. And this is printed. And it is, instead of eating her young, she leaves them unsupervised in front of Dora the Explorer. The outlets are all covered with hard plastic plugs and the AC is on. She left them sesame sticks and sippy cups. Then she runs outside and begins ripping out overgrown prickly weeds with her bare hands. There is no time for gloves, sunscreen, or discretion. She smiles as she pulls the stubborn weeds by their long roots, 99 degree heat on her 80 degree hillside, in gray flip-flops and pajamas, throwing her limp victims over her shoulder and onto the cracked sidewalk that should be replaced before winter. Damn it, she mumbles when a weed snaps in her fist and the root remains intact, a predator still in the ground, wrapping around her perennials. And now she can hear the kids screaming inside, drops a weed mid-pull to go back in. It's really, I think like, it's really hot outside now, like lately. So now it's like, oh, 99 degrees. Maybe I was exaggerating then. Maybe it was that hot, I don't know. So here's a poem that's on the phone. Also a pandemic poem. Okay. Where do they keep the eggs here anyways? An older woman on her phone, not respecting my my distance asks. I can see the saliva coming out of her thin, tight lips with every syllable projected at my masked face. A stay-at-home order has been issued by Governor Wolf, and the Facebook moms want to know, is anyone finding toilet paper? I am looking and I can't find any. I'm trying to create ambitious color-coded schedules for my wild children to follow during a pandemic. But they are jumping in puddles, tracking mud all over the house, and eating bits of popcorn off the dirty living room rug. Another Facebook mom posts, I guess I can use this quarantine time to work on my recipe book. Send me your favorite recipes, heart, heart. Maybe I should just use the same yellow and black caution tape closing off the neighborhood playgrounds like a crime scene. But now all I have is inside my house with my family. The Facebook moms group posts, with the malls closed, what are we all doing to obtain Easter bunny photos this year? At work, I watch an overweight 16-year-old in sweats and flannel Snoopy pajama pants go straight for the scissors, wildly stabbing the air and staff, barricading herself behind her classmate's desk. She begins slitting her wrists fast and deep, like it is nothing, and lets the blood pour out to pool on high traffic, ultra-thin carpet. I had a miscarriage and was asked, why would you try for another if you have three perfectly healthy children? I was gifted irises for sympathy that never bloomed. A week later, I yell, we don't throw scissors, to a bowl cut, bam, bam, high ponytail girl. And she replies, you're not my mother. I didn't come out of your vagina. I don't have to listen to you. Now I am being tested for COVID for the second time this month. My mortgage goes into default and my bank account has been emptied. But I'm trying to keep it tight, like the sushi roll on my grandmother's old flower china, although it has been chipped along the edges for years. Yes, uplifting. oh, so I was just thinking about this recently. Okay. The day before my sister's wedding, she was in her bed, feverish, telling me, it feels like someone's punching me in the ovaries. My mom says she isn't going to wait in some emergency room all night. At 2 a.m., mom texts, at Columbia University ER, been waiting 3 hours. My brother and I take the end of June, stifling Washington Heights subway down to the A car. The stairs are in disrepair. Over 20 people disappear into an overcrowded elevator. A few minutes later, the two woman operated elevator returns and we get in. They make more money than us, my also adjunct brother whispers loudly, and I don't feel his hot onion bagel breath because of the intense overpowering heat as we drop down to the subway level into the smell of mildew and hot grease. The standing operator yells, "Get out, please." Other operator is humming or singing into a small grimy rotating fan that's locked in her direction behind a thin wooden barrier. After 2 stops, we emerge from the subway in front of the ER. My sister was brought here earlier this morning, I tell a young man behind a large marble desk, and he hands me a pass marked visitor in bright orange, points me to a single glass door and tells me to go to station B, even though my sister is in D. Behind the glass door, everyone is losing or gaining some sort of fluid as I pass patients' open exam curtains. A 30-something Black woman is hunched over in a simple armchair, puking into her already full gown alone. Blood flows from her hung clear plastic OA and B positive negative bags through tubes to arms, and I can't find my sister without looking into each open curtain section. Finally, I slide the only closed curtain to find her laughing with a morphine drip. I hold her hand as a petite nurse prepares a penicillin injection for her. She hasn't even given you the shot yet, and you're squeezing my hand. She hasn't, my sister asks. The next day in the bridal suite, a short, sweaty makeup artist applies fake long lashes to my sister's closed eyes. I think she didn't even get her nails done for her wedding. Determined, I grab Wet n Wild's pearl pink and my sister's hand. The makeup artist backs away mid-second lash and tells me people can't work on a person at the same time. What's that, an old wives' tale? And she says something about multiple people working on the dead in the evil eye. Okay, here's another one. Okay. Young waitress walking. My black nylon skirt and white polo shirt clings to me like a stubborn onion peel. It has become another layer of skin from waitressing all day in an unair-conditioned kitchen. My tips are rolled together in a moist wad that was hardly worth the forced smiles reserved for customers that spoke extra low and quiet, forcing me closer and closer towards their eager hands that accidentally graze my teenage breasts, ass, or hip. Their breath, like the complimentary half-sour pickles, make me throw up in my mouth. I'm 15, walking down Lower Murray Avenue to my parents' home midsummer. The night sky is a dark, hazy purple, thick with humidity. I can hardly breathe. I jump to a stop as a cop car lights up and squeals beside me. A stocky officer with graying hair, black uniform, bright brass badge, jumps out and asks, "You walking alone?" I nod. "A pretty young girl like you, where's your big boyfriend to walk you home? It's not safe to be walking in the dark like that. I could drive you home. You shouldn't be out here." I wonder if I might be naked by the way he's gravitated and staring at my young, sweaty body. I respond that there is no boyfriend and I like to walk after work. He repeats, "You should at least let me take you home. Too young and beautiful to be walking around alone." He thinks he has loosened the onion skin, but I answer no thanks and continue walking down the loud city street with my teeth forever clenched. So a levaya in Judaism is like a funeral. So that's what this word means. Lewis's levaya. My grandmother didn't cry at my grandfather's humid Boca Raton funeral, didn't let the rabbi cut her sweater. Instead, she fell asleep and began to snore quietly. At home, she cried out of one blue infected eye. I hate to say it, but at least I have more closet space now. She left her clothes. Okay. Here's another one about my grandparents kind of in there. Rooted. Grandma Ruthie, age 4, with her younger brother, Joe, in the county orphanage. Her Russian mother on a mat quarantined with TB, and her father, Shia, peddled trinkets from a wooden wagon in Erie. 2 years later, he rode his horse, took Grandma Ruthie to school, riding through 2 feet of lake effect snow, cleaning out Grandma Ruthie's 70s mop dresser. I find small, thin slices of yellowed hotel soap she's been hoarding since the 50s. Don't you dare throw those away. What if we run out of soap someday? She's not wrong. My grandfather, Papa Louis, age 13 in Lawrenceville, quit school, worked as a butcher, white apron, rust red, blood smears off Penn Avenue. Fat lady, feather and hat, points at a slab. He's waited on her before. Papa Louis cuts and weighs, cuts again, weighs and presents. Fat feather lady yells, slice it thinner, thinner, thinner. And he mutters, Pollock. And she mutters, Pollock. Papa Louis runs around the corner, to the counter and smashes the cold raw steak into her fat face. His mother, Esther, doesn't care. She plays cards, smokes the cheap cigars, rides the jackrabbit alone, her wild short red hair always everywhere. The army gives Papa Louis a free haircut, trip to Italy, gives him a gun and a camera, says shoot. Esther gambles Papa Louis' paychecks and cries to her 5 younger children, I didn't even get to go to Kennywood this year. Aww. I was just at Kennywood recently and I was thinking about that. I thought it was pretty. Kennywood's such a weird place, especially when it's like 100 degrees, then it's the worst place too. And you have kids there, oh no, nothing worse. Okay, so here's some newer poems and then I'll read one older one and yeah. Okay, and then we can all go have one more reading and then go to the bathroom. It is almost spring 2021, 5:45 a.m. Monday morning. My 9-week-old daughter is laying on my chest, snoring loudly through her tiny nostrils, but I can't stop thinking of the favored heavy chef's knife in my dark kitchen drawer. My wrists are sore, everything is heavy. I have to reassure myself I will not drop my keys, phone, or baby, that I won't turn this corner too short, but I mostly end up driving over curbs. There's a lot of weird ones in here. Placenta sale, pending. I think of the small frozen placenta in the basement chest freezer now, solid. Everything a fetus needs to survive, clinging to the red biohazard bag. 13 months too late for top dollar. It might be freezer burnt. Sometimes when I am frantically looking for dinner options, while standing knee deep in dirty laundry, I want to eat the bloody thing, even though I'm vegetarian. Cook it up with shallots, pink salt and fresh rosemary, sizzled in the saucepan, but is past its peak. A couple months later, I bury it under a lilac sapling near the cracked patio out back on the third day of spring and hope my dog doesn't dig it up and bring it back inside. Placentas are weird, okay, but also powerful, so they're really interesting to me. This is an older poem, but I revised it. It is okay to be jealous of your slimmer, richer, suburban sister-in-law. She married the brother that can replace the knob and tube wiring, make more than the double the double chin beer belly brother you married. Her cat-like light crystal blue eyes, so deep yet hollow, open in shock a little too much when you speak, but she doesn't see you on the other side of the Liberty Bridge, emailing your online students in between the worst back labor contractions, to let them know you will be MIA for a couple of days giving birth. No one cares because you are going on 10 years of adjuncting. And 3 days postpartum, a student emails you in all caps, "When are you going to grade my essay already?" Question mark, question mark, question mark. You are the as disposable as the first pair of mesh underwear the nurse will help you step into with blood streaming down your thighs after birthing your son. Instead, your sister-in-law leaves your text questions hanging like the severed head of the plastic wrapper that hangs like a flag from your daughter's red freeze pop you have failed to remove. Okay, so I'm gonna read one more from here and then this one and then we'll be done with me. I mean, yeah. Goodbye, go to the bathroom. So I think, yeah, maybe I'll read. So Kayla, who's not here, because she has a movie night or something, always wants me to read this one, so I'll read it, even though she's not here. Doesn't deserve it, but I don't know, I was thinking about reading it anyways. And it's a true story. Everything in it is completely 100% true. Mr. T, Convention Center, St. Paul, Minnesota, early 90s. My mother didn't prepare me for Mr. T, for the cobalt blue spandex, tight bulge, big package yell, "Get in the picture, little fool." I held my fist tight against my turtle in the blue pond t-shirt and looked into the Polaroid camera, then turned eye level to Mr. T's blue bulge. He said, "I like your turtle, T, little girl." It's a true story. I got to meet him. He was really scary because I was really small, childish, because I was a child. Here's my last poem. And thank you for having me read. This is awesome. And I'm glad to have such great company to read with. And I am running a new series, not to plug it, but I'm going to plug it. Blue Cactus at Trace Brewing. Our next reading is August 28th with Joan Bauer, Celeste Gainey, Doralee Brooks, and Gwendolyn Mitchell. So that'll be at 2 p.m. on Sunday, August 28th. And there's food trucks, so you should really come to it. It's outside in the courtyard. If it rains, there's garage doors, so we'll be okay. Okay, it's my last poem, then I'll get out of your way. Or get out of the bathroom. Okay, not all kids are cute. Some will smack a blue foam noodle at the surface of the 8-foot pool until his parents comment, "Somebody wants attention," or open your crowded fridge looking for water, even though there is a dispenser on the door. Whack your 2-year-old on the head with a large vintage rusty gardening shovel in order to get your 2-year-old off his trampoline. He will yell at your 9-year-old daughter, "Who wants to see my penis while in the pool?" And you will happily serve all the other kids' frozen Dairy Queen chocolate cake, but conveniently forget to cut him the Pikachu decorated slice he's been claiming since you brought out the lit birthday cake. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Thank you, Dina.
Yeah.
Poems about reality. Okay. Adriana Eve Ramirez is a Mexican Columbia poet, critic, and writer. In 2015, in case you somehow didn't know this, she won the Pen Fusion Emerging Writers Prize for Dead Boys, published in 2016. And she served as critic at large for the Los Angeles Times book section, which is rather a big deal.
Yeah.
Yes. Woo-hoo. My old hometown paper. She is the recipient of the Pittsburgh Foundation's 2019 Carol R. Brown Creative Achievement Award. Her work can be found in the LA Times, ESPN's The Undefeated, Pen America, and Literary Hub. Adriana was once a nationally ranked slam poet, and she founded the infamous Nasty Slam in Pittsburgh and continues to perform around the country and her truly long-awaited book, The Violence, I mean, truly long-awaited book, The Violence, is forthcoming from Scribner, and it's going to be apparently out on September, October of 2023. So this is a really big deal. Please welcome Adriana E. Ramirez.
I think the lesson I've learned is to never write research-based nonfiction. I've been working on a book for 7 years, and every time they send back an edit, they're like, well, what about this? I'm like, oh, that's 5 months of research. Okay. So that's hence why it's taken so long. It's okay. It took Rebecca Skloot like 15 years to write The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. So I'm getting myself a little bit of a, you know, I've looked up all the people that took more than 7 years just to make myself feel better. There you go. So we got time. Toni Morrison was like in her 40s when she published her first novel. We got time. So I'm 38, right? It's cool, right? That's like not 40. So, okay. Here we go. This is called, this is an essay. It's called Everyone Loses on Jeopardy Eventually. If you want to read it online, it is at the Atlantic. And if you hate paywalls, hey, you're here. All right. The night before my episode of Jeopardy aired on national television, I had a nightmare. In the dream, everyone who knew me in high school gathered in a cafeteria to watch and laugh at how I aged, at my flubbed attempts to hit the buzzer, at every wrong answer. Their laughter chased me down the weird hallways of my mind, and I woke up covered in sweat and freaking out. My husband, that guy, however, woke up excited. You're going to be on TV tonight. Isn't it amazing? Only if he meant the original definition of amazing, which is closer to terrifying. In the 10 weeks between the taping of the episode and when it aired, my memory of what had happened grew fuzzy. Jeopardy's strict rules prevented me from discussing the results with anyone. Only my husband and fellow contestants knew how I'd done. I remembered the final outcome, obviously, but I couldn't recollect how I'd gotten there. As my air date approached, I realized that I was more scared to watch than I had been to play. I somehow made it through the day, doing my best to avoid the messages from friends who live in markets where Jeopardy airs earlier than 7 p.m. We planned a watch party at a bar in South Pittsburgh, and by the time I arrived, my friends had already filled up two long elevated tables. I settled uncomfortably into a too tall chair that made me feel like a child. After turning 10 televisions to the right channel, the owner of the bar announced to everyone that I'd be appearing on the show. We have a real Jeopardy contestant with us tonight. You gonna win? He asked. I shrugged, trying to look mysterious instead of like someone about to vomit. Strangers cheered and clapped. My friends made woo sounds. My giant face appeared on the screen, a writer from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Adriana Ramirez. I smiled, or at least stretched my mouth into a shape conveying optimism. I was about to lose, and lose hard. Trivia reinforces that we live in a culture that prioritizes winning. We remember what book won a Pulitzer in 1937, Gone with the Wind, the film that won Best Picture Oscar in 2000, American Beauty, and which horse won the Kentucky Derby in 2022, Rich Strike. The losers are too abundant and too obscure to recall, unless, of course, the loss transcends oblivion, see Al Gore. But if millions of people play trivia-based games every day in part to show that they know more than their friends and peers, the impulse goes deeper than that. Facts, unlike wealth or privilege, are accessible to anyone willing to obtain them. The acquisition of information is not limited by language or lot. My family moved from Mexico to Texas when I was a baby. My parents, both accomplished, understood the value of education for social mobility. Trivia felt like the kind of power that was within my reach. I started playing trivia as a kid with my folks on car rides to San Antonio and across the border to Monterrey. It was a way to learn about the places we visited. My mother confirmed our answers with a guidebook. We called this Ramirez Family Trivia, and I loved it. I loved knowing random facts as much as I loved winning. Trivia technically means unimportant information, but in certain contexts, all facts have value.
When I took my naturalization test at age 12 to become a United States citizen, I was asked 10 questions about American history and governance. Hours of Ramirez family trivia on a road trip to Washington, D.C. had prepared me more than reading a study guide had. Nothing about that felt trivial. I've kept up with my trivia habit over the years, captaining my high school quiz team, prevailing over strangers in weekly pub trivia nights in my 20s, and now competing in the championship of my online league, where I did really poorly as well. Last year, my husband convinced me to try out for Jeopardy with him. He made it to the second stage of auditions and plans to try again as soon as he can. I knew it was a long shot, so I didn't think I had a chance, even as I made it to the second and third stages. When I got the phone call telling me I'd made it onto the show this past February, I stood in my kitchen, doing my best to sound human as my legs and arms shook. After hanging up, I decided I had two goals: don't embarrass myself on national television and do my best to win. But competing on Jeopardy is not the same as outsmarting people at the dive bar down the street. The contestants on my episode were as well practiced as I was, as driven to win as I was, and as I found out, faster under pressure. Jeopardy is a true meritocracy. The only way to make it onto the show is to pass two different online tests and a practice game played on Zoom. There are no shortcuts. Only correct and quick answers to arbitrary clues can get you through. At our taping in March, the producers told us that more than 100,000 people had taken the initial online test in 2021. About 400 contestants compete in a regular season of Jeopardy, which means that 99.6% of people who took the first test last year did not make it to the Alex Trebek studio. The same year, Harvard rejected 96.6% of applicants. One of the core tenets of trivia is you either know it or you don't. No one can know everything. Reading and memorizing lists of facts can only take you so far. Before I competed, I spent weeks listening to a ton of classical music, assuming that opera or composers would come up. Neither did. During my watch party, my nerves took over and I began pacing the bar. For a minor eternity, I watched as my competitors buzzed in repeatedly and wondered if I had ever answered anything. Suddenly, I heard the host, Maya Bialik, say, "Adriano," after a clue about literary bears. I watched myself answer, "Who is Paddington?" incorrectly. Another contestant buzzed in with the right phrase, "Who is Gentle Ben?" My friends murmured in sympathy. Every time I buzzed in on the television, the bar cheered. The eight times television me answered correctly, real me got approving looks and big smiles. Someone bought me a beer. I began to relax. After the Jeopardy and Double Jeopardy rounds, television me ended up with a negative score and sat out Final Jeopardy in accordance with the rules. I remember television me wishing she could write down a wager and answer. The clue flashed on screen. Johnny Mercer's lyric to this 1961 Oscar-winning song once began, "I'm Holly." "Did you know it?" the owner of the bar asked me. I nodded. "What is Moon River?" "Good for you." On our Jeopardy contestant text thread, everyone was supportive. Ryan Long, who defeated everyone who challenged him in the five episodes that filmed that day, did not rub his greatness in our collective faces. We mostly complimented one another's wit and bemoaned our losses. And that's the thing about Jeopardy. Everyone loses eventually. Even Long, after a 16-game winning streak, had to take an L on national television. But as I came to understand while watching myself on television, there's no shame in that loss. In the bar that night, I was flooded with memories. I remembered being a kid, struggling to name rivers and scientists, the tears I cried at getting something wrong, the delight I would feel when the answer finally came to me in a breath of clarity, the way I would giggle with victory when my parents couldn't answer one of my questions. These were the fun parts of the game, tears included. We put too much stock in winning, dreaming of glory, money, or fame. I find that there is grace in loss and always a good story. To lose, pick yourself up, and walk away unscathed, nothing is more human or more badass. What we often forget is why we play in the first place, for the sheer fun of it. If you had told me when I was a girl that I would one day get to be on Jeopardy, I would not have believed you. I certainly would not have worried about losing. I had expected to be crushed with embarrassment when the episode ended. I wasn't. Not even a little bit. Don't get me wrong, I have regrets. I will never mix up Paddington and Gentle Ben again. But I came out stronger on the other side and also a little humbler. On the way home from the bar that night, my husband beamed with pride. I scrolled through my messages. People I hadn't heard from in a decade were posting on social media about my appearance. Childhood friends sent emails to an old Yahoo address. Was that you? No one cared that I'd lost. Most people were simply impressed. I, a person they knew, had made it onto Jeopardy. Almost 10 million people saw me lose on national television, and I've never felt more loved. One of the producers called Jeopardy a good trauma, and the phrase has stuck with me. I've since amended it to something more accurate, an amazing trauma, in the best sense of the word. Thank you for indulging me. We went through like 50 edits of that, so it's kind of fun to get to read it. And it's not something that happens very often. I'm just going to read a couple of poems and that will be done. Since everyone is plugging the things they do, I host a podcast. So, hey, if you like my listening to me talk and you want to listen to me talk like while doing other things, what's up? I'm out of here. It's called Charla, C-H-A-R-L-A, cultural. It means chat. Chatta, and just means cultural chat. And me and Carla Lamb do it through City of Asylum and Asterix Journal. So if you Google me, you'll find it. It's on like Apple and like Android and Spotify. So, ooh, okay. All right, here's a couple poems about dogs because, you know, dogs are awesome. That's really all I got. Dog and bird discuss flight, what dog remembers. There is a piece of raw hide I once buried so deep I lost its scent. There are cats I watched climb beyond my reach and bite. With wings, their bones would crunch the satisfied grinding of victory. I want so much to be you as I am, to love you as I make you myself, sweet bird. I can hold you tighter than you've ever been held. Tell me how to catch you. Tell me how to have you. Dog and bird discuss taste, what bird remembers. I grieve. This is not something most know, but birds grieve. I am not afraid to take flight when I have to. I have been carrion that's come. Tell me of pepper, of sneezing, of wine. Tell me the story of bacon and cream. I hear the skin is salty, remind me. What is salty? I've got a beak made for the eyes, a cross mark for underbelly. I cannot taste this broken wing or cracked sorrow. And yet I can still taste your poison, old friend. Thank you. And then just two more poems and I'm done. This is called Devoradora. In Spanish, devoradora means devourer, one who devours. And there's a pun here with the name Deborah. So devora is Deborah, the name. Devoradora is one who devours. Devoradora. The summer I am 9, we mock Deborah. I stand on the monkey bar taller than my June aspirations. The woman on the street screams mango like it's a song. And I think about why I'm never hungry in Barranquilla, always too hot to eat. Deborah buys mango and ice covered in leche condensada. So much for playground tag, I think. I don't like the climb down. Deborah, Deborah. The first cry, not mine. We laugh, we laugh, we laugh. I laugh too. Soon, the chant grows ugly. Devoradora, devoradora. Deborah cries, drops the mango on the ground. I want to pick it up, but instead hide it in the dirt with my shoe. Devoradora, eat the vowels when you say it quickly. Say it quickly. Devoradora, swallow the word whole. It's a doggy dog world. This is how my mom says it's a dog eat dog world. She just goes, it's a doggy dog world. And it's like my favorite thing. So it's a doggy dog world. Colonel Dinosaur curls up next to me, his wet nose soon in my lap, his schnauzer mustache improbable. When I ignore him, he doth complain. His furry eyebrows insistent, his tongue a quiet alarm raspy in its metronome. For a bit, I indulge him, scratching snout and ears, his nubby tail stump wagging furiously, a windshield wiper in monsoon. Soon, I tire. I cannot caress him infinitum. Like all humans, I cannot love anything an eternity except in promise. When I stop, he will sit in protest, roll over, expose belly, vulnerable as all creatures begging love must be. I offer him a shrug as the other dogs muck their way through his line of sight. And Colonel Dinosaur leaves me for them because, you know, bitches.
Thank you so much. So I want to thank you all for being here tonight. I want to say a big thank you to the Zoom world, all our friends on Zoom. I know there are a lot of you there tonight, so I really appreciate you coming and Zooming in for this reading. We will be back next May. We'll do 8 more weeks next summer. And of course, I want to say thank you to White Whale. I want to say a big thank you to Chris. It was just amazing. Just amazing. Yes. And we have a lot of books for sale here tonight. And we have some really wonderful books by remarkable poets and writers. And I hope you'll take one or two home and support this bookstore. And we have some other books too. But we, of course, want to. So thank you all and happy summer and stay safe. You take care. Bye.